Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Todd Kim. I represent the District of Columbia in this appeal. To be valid, a class before the individual claims are aggregated must possess the common contention required by the Supreme Court and Walmart. Plaintiff's class lacks that necessary common contention because each individual claim encompassed within the class turns essentially on individualized contentions. Contentions like, I am disabled within the meaning of the IDEA. I was not found by the District of Columbia's Child Find program. I thereby suffered a deprivation of my right to a FAPE, a free appropriate public education.
The plaintiff suggests that the district has failed to distinguish this case from the usual, well, strike the word usual, from civil rights cases, where the ultimate relief may be individualized, but the general claim, the legal claim, is common to all.
I think that plaintiffs may so suggest, but they don't come to grips with what the Supreme Court said in Walmart. And I don't think the implications of our position should call into question most of the civil rights litigation that you're talking about.
Well, let me just ask you, Walmart was concerned, in my reading, with the fact that there was no corporate-wide uniform policy. Here, we do have, do we not, a system-wide policy made at the highest levels of the district government?
I respectfully disagree on both of the premises of your question. Let me begin with what Walmart stands for. Certainly, Walmart discussed the presence or absence of policies that would link together all the different claims encompassed within the class. But it did so crucially after it discussed the meaning of Rule 23. The meaning of Rule 23 was really discussed in the very first paragraph under subsection 2A of the Supreme Court's decision. There, the court discusses what Rule 23 means, and it is the meaning of Rule 23 as described on Walmart that we think controls this case. When they talked about the particular factual context of that case, Title VII, they twice used the introduction, for example, making clear that it wasn't just Title VII they were talking about, it was Rule 23.
So think of all these civil rights cases where the particular injury, if we get into the question of relief, is very specific. Are you saying Walmart says there is no Rule 23 right to proceed by class action in
those
cases?
No, Your Honor, I would not go that far. I don't think this court needs to go that far. We're asking the court to take just a more modest step that this particular class was not properly certified. To speak to your question more directly, so we're somewhat blending of the 23B2 analysis, but it also pertains to 23A2. The Supreme Court in Walmart talked about things like civil rights cases in which plaintiffs sought relief to stop segregation. There are certainly ways consistent with Walmart, and the Supreme Court did not suggest in any way that this would not be possible for plaintiffs to continue to seek that kind of class-wide relief. But what they've done here is quite different. They haven't even suggested that there is any particular policy or practice that links every claimant. Now, perhaps that can be forgiven somewhat because, of course, they designed this class before Walmart came down. But even before then, we did tell the district, we don't think this is a proper class because they have essentially taken a shotgun approach.
They have claimed that there are policy deficiencies.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. Let me be clear. They absolutely think there are policy deficiencies. The district court found as much. What I'm saying is different. What I'm saying is that Walmart required them to do a little more than that.
Even the cases you're relying on, the Seventh and Fifth Circuit, understand it's a distinguished situation if you're talking about a there's no doubt that in the IDEA context, individuals have very distinct kinds of issues. And that if that's all we were talking about, it would seem bizarre to say, well, let's collect everyone who falls under the IDEA regime and create a class. Sure. It seems to be entirely different if you're talking about plaintiffs who claim, look, we're IDEA claimants. We face, as a group, policy impediments. Let's take a hypothetical, for example. Suppose D.C., hypothetical now, okay?
Sure.
Suppose D.C. has a policy that can be shown that tells its people, with respect to child find issues, don't read anything that anyone submits. Sure. Have a class action?
Yes, Your Honor.
You betcha. And there are lots of policies like that. Now, my understanding is that's what they're asserting, and that's what the district court has found. Now, you may argue that the district court's wrong with respect to the asserted policy deficiencies, but even the Seventh Circuit, which walloped the notion, says, but if you're talking about policy, of course you could have a class action if they're the claims are based on policy deficiencies, because everyone in the group would be similarly affected, and we're not dressing, they're not pulling themselves together, as the Supreme Court said, they're not pulling themselves together based on their different individual claims, they're pulling themselves together based on their common assertion that we can't get through this system. None of us can, because the system isn't built correctly.
Your Honor, let me address the various threads in your question, if I may. I'll try to pull them out, and I'll try to work in both your hypothetical, what the district court did here, and the Seventh Circuit, since you adverted to that. The hypothetical is different from this case, and we think it's critically different in this way. In your hypothetical, there was a single policy that affected all the class members. If that were the assertion here, we would have a very different argument, but it's not the assertion here. The assertion here is that there are a number of different policies that each affect.
Well, you can have more than one.
Well, absolutely.
There's no rule that says it's limited to just one policy.
No, I agree with that.
Okay.
But even if they want to show that there's more than one common contention, they must show that there is at least one. And what the Walmart court said is that it has to link together each and every one of the claims. There's not even an assertion here that there's any particular policy that links every one of the claims here, nor could there be. If you look at on the face of their list of policies.
You're saying
policies,
there should be subclasses.
I'm saying possibly there could be subclasses. We don't know. The plaintiffs have not even asked this court to certify subclasses. That would be something we fully agree the plaintiffs could suggest to the district court on remand. We think this class, however, is invalid. Going back to the threads in your question.
I mean, I'll hear what they have to say on the policy. It's not my reading of the record, but I mean, it seems to me that they have made the argument that there are overarching policies that are impediment to anyone who's put in the system.
No, I think if you look at their list of policies, they are on their face things that apply to only subsets of the class. The class, as the court is well aware, encompasses things like the identification, location, evaluation, and provision of services to disabled children.
The totality is the denial, the alleged denial of a statutory right by virtue of policy 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
And
you cannot bring a Rule 23, you're saying under Rule 23A, Walmart would forbid that type of class action?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that they do not design their class around any policy that links the class as a whole. They may be able to do subclasses. That's not the question before this court right now. What they did was quite different. And if I may return to your question, Judge Evers, because I want to make sure I address it fully. The district court here did not find that there was any particular policy that linked everything. What it said was that there were systemic deficiencies. Undoubtedly, it's so found. We don't think that meets the Walmart standard. Indeed, if that were so, imagine a circumstance when a class proponent comes in and says, I would like to certify a class of all people who we say were wrongfully denied workers' compensation benefits by the District of Columbia, period.
Wrongfully what?
Denied workers' compensation benefits by the District of Columbia. Or to put it a little differently.
No, that's really very different to me. That's very different.
Analytically, I think it's the same, Your Honor, with respect.
I don't think it is at all, because then you really are talking about individual claims where I have to look at each one and say, well, you're not claiming there's anything wrong with the policies here or the system that you're going to be involved with. You're saying that a lot of us think we were improperly denied.
Right. But
that's a very different kind of a claim. You're on very strong ground there, I think.
Well, let me then expand my hypothetical a bit.
Okay.
So give you a few more facts in my hypothetical. In my hypothetical, the plaintiffs also say there are many policies we think are deficient, many, many. Let's say, hypothetically, of course, the District of Columbia's workers' compensation system, they say, is broken. It's been broken for years. But there's no particular thing that caused any particular, and there's no particular thing they can point to that connects all the claims. There is not within the parlance of Walmart.
I think yes, there's an obligation by purported class members to point to something. You can't just come in and say, you know, D.C., whatever it is they have, it's nonsense. And so we're all here.
I'm glad we're speaking only hypothetically.
That's not good. I agree. But I don't think that's what they're doing.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I think analytically.
You think it's nothing more than that. They're just saying, you know, this is, the system's just stupid.
I think,
and that's it.
Sorry. I do think it's
really, I'm trying to understand. You think it's nothing more than, I want to set it up so they can respond to you, because if you're right, then they've got problems. But I didn't think that's what they were doing.
It is what I think they're doing analytically. I agree that they have dressed it up a little more. They have said that there are lots of policies that are affecting a lot of people. But what I think Walmart required, and let me return to the language of Walmart, is that there be a common contention capable of class-wide resolution. And the Supreme Court defined what that means. It means that determination of its truth or validity will resolve an issue central to each of the claims in one stroke.
Right. So my hypothetical starting out would be an example. There is a policy or practice, which is with respect to child find, the way we operate here is just ignore any of the papers. You could join a whole class, right?
If it was just ignore all of the papers, that would be very different from what we have here.
The answer, you should give the answer yes to that, right? The answer is yes. If all the, tell me why it's not. Right.
No, wait.
I'm trying my best.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't know which answer.
All right. Let's start with Judge Edwards. All right. Okay. Do you want to repeat the question so he's clear?
No, absolutely. Well, with a caveat, and this caveat is important. As I started to say in my introduction, the claims here are individualized claims, and plaintiffs themselves emphasize in their brief that it does not matter.
No. Just do my hypothetical.
Okay, well, I'm trying to give a caveat, but the hypothetical is, given the caveat that I haven't yet articulated, the answer is yes. Yes, with that caveat that I can explain if you want. Yes, if there is a policy, a particular policy that in fact links all the class members, all of them, because that's what Walmart requires, then yes, everyone there, every child there who was denied a FAPE because the District of Columbia hypothetically refused to even read their papers could join together in the class.
So in your reading of Walmart, you could have a series of individual plaintiffs arguing about a particular policy. The district court could consolidate those cases and move forward and allow basically what has happened in this B2 class?
Conceptually, yes, of course, the district court would have to consider numerosity, typicality, and all the other 23 factors. I don't think that suggests that what happened here could go forward with subclasses.
So I just need to be very clear about this, because it seems to me, I know you don't want to quite deal with this, but in the civil rights cases, we have situations where there are a number of separate policies where it is alleged result in discrimination. And here, the umbrella is the Child Find program and the allegation that the district has a pattern and practice through various policies of not complying with the statutory obligation regarding child find.
I understand your concern, if I may address it, while also getting to the caveat I tried to give Judge.
Oh, yeah, before. Tell us the caveat.
Okay, because they're all intermingled here.
All right.
I'll try to address them both in this answer. In the civil rights cases you speak of, especially the discrimination cases, much as in Walmart itself, the reason for the challenged government decision was part of the liability analysis. It was an essential part of it. That was why the Supreme Court could inquire into whether the Walmart class shared commonality based on the reasons for the challenged employment decisions. Mm-hmm. The caveat I was getting to here is that IDEA, and in particular the portion of IDEA we're talking about, is critically different from those. IDEA does not depend upon the reason for the decisions. So that is one fewer basis for plaintiffs to show commonality here. Now, the policy and practice that led to various child find failures could conceivably link plaintiffs together in some sense, but I don't think it's the sense that the Supreme Court required.
It doesn't rely on the reasons for the decisions.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What do you mean it doesn't rely on the reasons for the decisions?
According to the plaintiffs, the liability
question.
You mean
in any IDEA case or this case?
This case. For the plaintiffs, the question here is essentially binary. Was the child found or not? There are other subsidiary questions as well. Was the child disabled, et cetera, et cetera? But according to plaintiffs, and we have to agree with this, the reason for a child not to be found is not part of the liability analysis to begin with. So that's one less basis for them to show commonality. And it distinguishes this case from both Walmart and the greater body of civil rights cases to which you adverted, Judge Rogers. So as I was saying in the very beginning of this, each individual claim here encompassed within the class is essentially individualized. Nothing in it turns on the question whether the District of Columbia's system as a whole is doing well. That's just not part of it. They're attempting to skip over the essential part of the Rule 23A2 analysis by saying that we can show commonality after aggregation.
That is interesting, and it's a thoughtful response, but the problem is you jumped a step in terms of the way they're trying to frame their case. They're saying we don't have to get to reasons. We can't even get in the system. It's not operating. It doesn't invite us to do what the law says we can do. So, of course, we're not at reasons. We're not within a system that works. We're kind of, the door is shut. That's what they're saying. If the door were open, then maybe we would have common reasons that we could join together in addition. But we're saying the door is shut.
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First, I don't
I
think...
like you always have two responses.
I try. Next time I'll mix it up and give you three. The first response is that idea, and I'm over time. I hope the court will allow
Please
me to continue
go
speaking.
Yeah.
The first response is that I don't think idea just allows them to do that. There's no cause of action in idea allowing them to skip over the individual entitlement relief, and the individual entitlement relief relies on just whether they were found or not.
Well, that's now the cause of action question. I was wondering whether you were going to raise that. I mean, there is certainly legislative history. That's a tricky question. There's legislative history way back, which I'm sure you're aware of, that certainly says that there are more than just individual claims that can be pursued under IDEA. Well, is that what you're trying to address?
I was not trying to get to argument two of my brief. I was still on argument one.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, the second response I was going to give you is whether or not the proper reading of Rule 23 allows plaintiffs to do things that they think are fair and efficient and promote social ends is not the question. The question is, what does Rule 23 require? And Rule 23 here, the Supreme Court has told us, requires a certain thing. It requires a common contention of such a nature that it's capable of class-wide resolution. Determination of its truth or validity will resolve an issue central to the validity of each one of the claims, every claim in the class, in one stroke.
So you would agree, if I'm right by my analogy, that they're all saying the door is closed. That's a legitimate class claim.
If they say that there is a policy that the door is closed, right. With the caveat I gave before, which I think is a significant caveat, that the reasons are not even relevant to any individual claim here, then yes. But then,
I'm clear about this. If a system is broken because of a pattern and practice that is based on a variety of policies, are you saying that under IDEA there can never be a class action that makes that claim because you can't even get past 23A?
No, Your Honor. I'm not speaking so broadly as to all IDEA class
action. So if in that situation you get beyond A, then what is your argument?
Well, if you get beyond A, there's still the independent argument under Rule 23B2. 23b2, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, and even pursuant to its plain text, requires that the class as a whole be entitled to an indivisible injunction. In the words of 23b2, the actor opposing the class must have acted or refused to act on grounds generally applicable to the class.
All right, so the way I interpret what the district court said is, I am issuing an injunction that says the district has to comply with the child find obligations in the statute. And here's what they have to do because they have to change certain policies they have. Now, that's in one fell swoop.
Right. Let us distinguish what the district court did here and what 23b2 requires, which is that the class warrant an indivisible injunction. So let's look at the class here and break down some of the subcategories, because I think it's very hard to see how one injunction is warranted by the entire class, which is what B2 requires. Let's start with the category of claimants for whom injunctive relief was never at issue.
What? Excuse me. I'm sorry.
I said let's start with the category of claimants for whom injunctive relief was never even at issue. Mm-hmm. There's a category of claimants that came to the district court having already been found The only issue for them was what prospective individualized relief would be due to them, compensatory education, reimbursement, and the like. Then let's break down the categories of claimants for whom injunctive relief could actually be at issue. There's no dispute that the reasons why particular class members were failed may have nothing to do with one another. Some of them were not identified. Some were not located. Some were not evaluated. Some were not provided services. Some were not smoothly transitioned from Part C to Part B. And even within any of those particular administrative functions, there may be very different reasons why one child as opposed to another is not identified. And then layer on top of that the case that this class is open-ended. There is no time limit built into the class. Any child, even in the year 2020, for all we know, who is not found at the time that she or he is 3 to 5, will be a member of this class, irrespective of how the District Court of Columbia's policies change. There's no dispute.
So that latter clause, the District Court gave you an option there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The latter clause about no matter what the district does, the District Court clearly allows the District of Columbia to come back to court and say we've changed the policies.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. And I'm not saying that the District of Columbia will be under this injunction forever.
Yeah.
The District of Court did not contemplate that. I'm saying something different. What I'm saying is that the class as designed is open-ended. It does not admit of the possibility that the District of Columbia's policies will in fact change radically, as they have. Everyone recognizes that the District of Columbia is doing much, much better now than it did at the time this class was certified.
Do you want to talk about 23B3 for a moment?
Sure, Your Honor.
I'm going to go back.
We're going
to go back to this, so I can wait till the end.
No, go ahead. I don't want to.
So I just want to see if I can hone down your argument to the narrowest ground upon which you think you need in order to win, not all these 25 other arguments and Part 2 and Part 3, just Part 1. So as I understand it, the class that they've listed, which is, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but would include, for example, all children who are eligible for special education and were not identified, right?
Sure.
But it will also include all children who are eligible, who have been identified, but have not been evaluated. But haven't been evaluated.
That's true.
Right.
The class doesn't include both.
And at the minimum, your argument is those two different injunctions are needed in order to reach those two different classes. There's no one injunction that will solve the problems of both of those two subclasses. I'm going to use the word subclasses as a shorthand. I'm not sure subclass is the right way to think about this rather than separate classes, perhaps in a consolidated case. But your point is that under the Supreme Court's opinion in Walmart, which appears to have changed the law, there must be one injunction that can, in one stroke, resolve the problems of all the children, right? And your position is, even as to those two, and there are probably about 20 ways in which this could be cut up, as to those two, there is no one injunction that will solve the problems of the people in both those subclasses. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for that reason alone, it's not necessary for us to consider all of your other attacks on the IDEA, all of your other attacks under the Rehabilitation Act. All that's necessary is to send it back to the district court to see whether there's any basis for, and I'm going to use again the word subclasses, which might define subclasses in a way that separate injunctions as to each might solve the problem. And I read your brief, because I highlighted about 5 places where you said, we don't disagree that the case should be remanded to determine whether that's done. And that's all that we need to worry about today. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Now, where does Walmart say an injunction cannot have subparts?
The language of the Walmart court.
It says one stroke. And I don't see anything about you can't have an injunction that has many, many parts and subparts, et cetera.
What Walmart says with regard to, I'll talk about 23B2 for a second.
Right.
The analyses are blending. Walmart says the key to the B2 class is, quote, the indivisible nature of the injunctive or declaratory relief warranted. The notion that the conduct is such that it can be enjoined or declared unlawful only as to all of the class members or as to none of them. So I think it's very hard for the reasons Judge Garland articulated to see how that test is satisfied here. Consider, for instance, the fact that everyone agrees, indeed, plaintiff's expert testified, that there will be a certain percentage of children who are not found absolutely due to no fault whatsoever of the District of Columbia, some parents will not make their children available to be evaluated for special education. And of course, there's the separate question of all the different claimants falling in different categories for whom entirely different injunctions will be warranted, because for one, it would be a failure of identification, and for another, it would be a failure of evaluation.
So I just need to be clear how far the district wants to take this. I mean, surely we have to read Walmart in its factual context. All right, and it didn't say we're amending Rule 23. It said we're just expounding on the meaning of Rule 23. So if the allegation of plaintiffs is that a system is broken for 25 different reasons that involve 5 different policies, and all of this adds up to the district not having a lawful child find program, Walmart's interpretation of Rule 23 bars an injunction that would address all of these issues in order to bring the district, hypothetically, into compliance with its child find obligations, period. You cannot bring that type of litigation after Walmart. Is that the district's position?
No, Your Honor, it's not. We don't think this court need declare anything so radical in this particular
case.
But
why isn't that the result of your position?
Because what Walmart requires is more modest than that. It requires that plaintiffs design their classes around properly understood common contentions. So with the significant caveat.
The common contention here, there is a common contention. Let me put it grossly. I mean, the system is broken.
Right, but the common contention in that sense.
And it says to the district court, fix it.
Right. The common contention, according to the Walmart court, cannot be something like that. The Walmart court, in fact, listed how any competently crafted class complaint can include lots of literally taken common questions, but that's not good enough. So returning to my caveat, which I keep on returning to here, there's nothing in any individual claim encompassed within this class that turns on whether the system as a whole is broken. That question comes into play only after aggregation, but that's not the way class certification works. First, you have to show the common contention in order to satisfy Rule 23A2 before you even get to aggregate. So I don't think it will do after Walmart to say the system is broken, therefore I can sue as a class.
All right, if the plaintiff class had been able to show that Walmart Corporation had 3 or 4 policies that were adversely affecting only female employees, would the case have come out differently?
I think it probably would have, Your Honor. Actually returns to Judge Edwards' question from before, because I did want to get to that Seventh Circuit thread in your question.
Yes, you want to talk about
the Seventh Circuit and the trilogy of employment cases we discussed in our reply brief after Walmart has, I think, illustrated this principle. That, of course, is the Title VII context. So the reason for the challenge decision is relevant there, unlike here. But with that caveat again, there the Seventh Circuit, I think, made clear in Ross and then McReynolds and then Bolden that what you really need is a policy, or maybe two, as in McReynolds, that truly links every class member. And it was the presence or absence of such a policy that, in fact, justified the certification of a class.
All right.
But that's what we lack here.
All right. Thank you. We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh, did you have a series of questions?
No, no. Your Honor, may it please the court. I'm Bruce Terrace. I represent the plaintiffs and the appellees. I think counsel has painted too broad a picture about what the case is about. One has to look at the 4 violations that were found by the district court. The first violation, which was most of what the discussion was about before Your Honors, was the failure to identify large numbers of disabled children. But the other 3, and that involved numerous policies, and I'm going to come back to that. The other three statutory violations involve really one simple prohibition for each one of them: the failure within 120 days to do evaluations. That's not a policy; it's a rule, and the law is very, very simple. You just match up the people, the children, against the time limit.
Same thing on the termination with the 120 days, and the same thing with transitions to from Part B, C to Part B by the third birthday. So let me go back to
that's
the first.
Why you suggested to the district court subclasses that made
that's
those.
That's exactly right.
So what's wrong? What's wrong with? I mean, unfortunately, the district court did not adopt your position, and if they had, perhaps we would have a different case here.
Well, I don't think it's a really different case. I don't think the failure that would have made the situation much neater, and I think that's the way it probably should have been done, and we wouldn't have suggested it.
Well, the district court's position was Walmart did not require that.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that's really, I think, the subclasses would have made the lined up the class subclasses in this case with the actual issues in the case more clear. It wouldn't have changed the litigation in any respect. There's no prejudice to the defendant.
So are the plaintiffs taking the position that subclasses are required here?
No, we do not take that position. But if Your Honor thinks that the subclasses would are required, then I think there should be a remand to have that done. The reason I would argue that makes really is no purpose to that is it would simply come back to this court again with the subclasses. There's been no prejudice. The litigation was about the merits, of course. It wasn't about nobody was in confusion.
There isn't a no prejudice exception to Rule 23. That's the problem here. I mean, we have to come out with this correct. The Supreme Court has issued one big case on this subject. There's no doubt they're going to be issuing more big cases on this subject. It would be better if this court reached the correct decision rather than said this decision is not correct, but no one's prejudiced, because there is no harmless error rule under Rule 23. Am I wrong? Or maybe there is a harmless error that I rule that I don't know about.
There's certainly nothing written into Rule 23, but I think for almost all principles of the law, if there's no prejudice, there is no need to reverse and simply go back and have something done this court instructs the district court to consider, and it comes back here for on the same basis. So I think lack of prejudice is always written in, virtually always, maybe not for jurisdiction or things like that, but virtually always written in judicial rules. Now let me go to the identification arm, because that does involve, as counsel said, a variety of policies. There's a very important distinction between Walmart, the issues in Walmart, and the issues in this case. Walmart involves a negative, whether the defendant has done something in a negative way that is illegal. In other words, if there's no compulsion to hire women in the Walmart situation, there is a prohibition that you cannot discriminate against women in making promotions. Our case involves an affirmative duty under IDEA, the affirmative duty to identify students who are disabled. Now, in order to try that issue, you have to look at all the policies relating to identification of the defendant. If we had pointed to one policy, a policy, for example, that said that their public awareness campaign was no good, that it was inconsistent with the practice across the country that had worked, the comeback to that would have been, well, that's not the only policy that affects identification. We have 10 other policies that affect identification. So we say maybe there was a defect in that public awareness policy, but you haven't proven that we failed to carry out IDEA. In order to prove that we failed to carry out IDEA, you have to look at our entire program in which we identify children. That's what led, in their case, they would try to explain it away, that the District of Columbia had the lowest identification rate by far in the country. So we had to examine all those policies. And in turn, the district court had to give a common answer, as the Supreme Court directed us in Walmart. They gave a common answer to what needed to be done in order to have a valid, a compliant child find policy, identification policy under the statute. Now, let me go one step further, and that's the question about whether you can have whether in the same case you can have different statutory violations. It's, I think, incomprehensible that the Supreme Court in Walmart said you couldn't join two claims in the same case. I mean, I think that's incomprehensible. There's no law that would support it, and there's no language in Walmart that suggests it. It just happens, however, this identical issue was decided by the Seventh Circuit last month. In the Johnson case, Judge Posner wrote the opinion. He basically said what I said, even probably more strongly.
But there, the violations of all affected all members of the class, right? Both?
No, they did not. And what they had was a variety of subclasses, and there were 10.
Oh, they had subclasses.
Yes, they had subclasses, and they had 10 different. He said it was extremely confusing to try to figure out who fit into what, but there was no possibility that you can't join claims in the same case.
That's a different. But it didn't say you could do that without having subclasses, I take it.
Excuse me?
That case.
Well, he didn't say you also needed subclasses. Right. It happened in the cases that came before him. It had been divided into subclasses. And that is the neater way to do it. I'm not going to suggest to Your Honors, we suggested it ourselves to the district court. How can I say to you that I didn't think there was
a way? Can I ask you just one question about the subclass question? So is there a difference between subclass? I mean, one way, unfortunately, perhaps from your point of view, to read the rule is subclass has to be a subclass of a class, and therefore the class has to have all the same elements that Walmart would require. Another way is to think about them as just separate classes would happen to be joined in a consolidated case. Does that make any difference from your point of view?
Walmart does say, and I just as Judge Posner found in the Johnson case, I don't think it does require that there'll be an overlap in all the subclasses. In fact, I think the point of a subclass is there are very frequently different people in the different.
I'm just thinking from a litigation point of view, does it matter if they're called subclasses or if they're called separate classes that have been consolidated for purposes of the case?
Probably not. Yeah. In fact, I think really that's all that would result if you said that the district was correct on this proposition that you can't join these things, then all you would have in the next case that came along, you'd have four cases brought and then
all consolidated.
A motion to consolidate, yeah, right. Which serves, I think, no possible purpose. Let me go back.
It might not serve a purpose in this case, but in a case where there's notification, there might be different notification issues with respect to each of the subclasses, and that's usually the reason why there are subclasses, right?
And I think what would happen in this case, and in fact, will happen in this court, firms as we hope it does, when it goes back under B3, which is what the court recertified with a hybrid under B2 and B3, there would then be discussion about the notice, and in fact, there have been discussions with the district about notice, and proposals have been made on notice to the district court, and they are now pending, but of course, they're not before Your Honors for review. But that's exactly the kind of issues that would now be determined. Let me come back, though. I think the central.
The parties, the appellants, weekly, or not as vigorously as they do on the class question, and you offer a response. I want to hear what you have to say on the claim that, on the argument that there's no cause of action here under IDEA, because there is at least one concurring opinion in the circuit suggesting just that IDEA is an individual by individual process. It does not endorse a cause of action for class claims. And I mean, there are a number of, and you don't have a 1983 action here. District court didn't feel that was appropriate. No court has addressed it well. The most that some of the circuits suggest is you can avoid the exhaustion requirement if it would be futile because it's something more than just if it's something more than just the individual claim. What is your response on the cause of action question?
Well, I don't think it's actually a cause of action argument. I think it's an argument that class actions, there's nothing wrong with our cause of action. That's not been appealed even, so it's not before this court. But that the class action doesn't lie under IDEA. Numerous cases of class actions under IDEA, which never been questioned. Two cases in this court, Blackman and Petty's been in this court.
And what?
Petty's.
Pettit?
Petty's.
I may be mispronouncing it, if I apologize.
No, because it was a Pettit case, too.
Yeah. And numerous cases all across the country, it's never been doubted. And Supreme Court's decision in Califano v. Yamashita says that the federal rules apply to all cases in federal court unless there's a clear expression by Congress that they do not apply. There's no such expression here. Class actions were even discussed in the legislative history. There's no reason to believe that class actions don't lie under this statute. Let me go to the point.
As long as we're on sort of sidetrack issues, I'm sidetracked a little bit on the Rehabilitation Act issue. So my first question is, does it matter? That is, do you need, and then I want to ask about how the Rehabilitation Act can fit in here, but why do you need a separate cause of action under the Rehabilitation Act?
Well, we don't, of course, if we win under if we win under IDEA. But for example, Judge Edwards' question.
But if you did win under IDEA, you wouldn't need the Rehabilitation Act.
I think that's correct.
Just may ask about the Rehabilitation Act. So the statute, of course, says.
May I just make one caveat to that? Yeah. It's conceivable that, and I don't want to say that what the answer is, that it affects attorneys' fees.
Oh, okay, fair enough. So it says. No otherwise qualified individual with a disability shall, and then it has the phrase, solely by reason of her or his disability, be excluded from participation in, blah, 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 federal programs. Citing the Monahan case, which gives no explanation, the court says you don't have to show solely by reason of its disability. All you have to do is show gross mismanagement. And that's enough to say that the failure to provide a FAPE is a violation of the Rehabilitation Act.
Correct.
And I guess I'm unclear what the argument is. Normally, solely by reason of the disability has to mean person is being excluded from some program, for example, a FAPE, because of the disability. But as the government says, everybody who gets a FAPE has a disability. So I'm unclear about how just a terrible government program in terms of mismanagement, which doesn't intentionally or even erroneously discriminate on the basis of disabled versus non-disabled, fits under that language.
I think the implicit reasoning, and it isn't spelled out, so I'm only have to infer what the court meant, that there's a point in which when the Congress has provided for a benefit to disabled people, that there's a point where the action of the government is so egregious that, using the language of Monahan, gross misjudgment or gross departure from accepted the practices of educational professionals, that it's so egregious that is has the effect of saying that you are discriminating against people on the basis of their disability.
I can understand how those kind of language can be used to substitute for intent. That is sort of as a deliberate indifference sort of issue. But still the problem of how, basically you're just substituting this as if the Rehabilitation Act requires adherence to the IDEA.
Well,
without showing sort of the thing that the Rehabilitation Act is about, which is discriminating on the basis of disability.
There are regulations under the Rehabilitation Act
that
require a FAPE.
Yes.
In other words, so it's in effect been interpreted as carrying out.
Right. So the Office of Education did issue those regulations. They do basically say, they don't even require gross mismanagement. They just say you have to provide a FAPE under the Rehabilitation
Act. Right.
The government has not raised what I think sort of the question, the big elephant in the room is, where did that come from? I mean, I understand how that can be a regulation under the IDEA. I'm a little bit less clear on how that by itself can be a regulation under the Rehabilitation Act.
Well, I think the reason that it can be is because that act is intended to make sure that in government, in programs where the government has provided the money to states, that they carry out all the requirements of federal law. And so I think what they've simply done is pick up from IDEA one of the requirements of federal law. And
doesn't that office have authority under IDEA also? After all, it's under the office of it. The reason IDEA applies is also because of taking of government funds. It's the spending clause also. They could have issued the regulation there. This regulation, which is issued under the Rehabilitation Act, just says recipient that operates a public elementary or secondary program has to ensure free appropriate public access without reference to mismanagement or non-mismanagement or discrimination or not. Yeah. Okay.
I think I can't do that.
I understand. I can't.
Let me come back to the point I wanted to make, and then I will sit down. Counsel's argument in this case about there aren't common policies simply doesn't even look at the record in the case. Every bit of evidence in front of the district court was of common policies and a common issue.
All right, as I understand it, looking at Walmart, counsel's relying on, he says, part 2A. And that's where the court's talking about suffering the same injury. And this is the language on which I focused that said, quote, their claims must depend on a common contention. For example, the assertion of a discriminatory bias on the part of the same supervisor.
Right.
All right, so.
That's an example, however, not, obviously not.
Well, I read that to work in your favor, candidly, as opposed to cutting back.
Right.
That's what the concern of the court was in terms of how broadly or narrowly Rule 23 applies. So here you have the same supervisor, namely the Chancellor of Education, et cetera. And your discussion with Judge Garland about the nature of discriminatory bias, et cetera, comes from the policies that the district court found were creating the violation of the No Child Found program. I just want to understand what you think in the Walmart analysis pushes you to the subclass approach.
There's really only in the sense that there are different arguments and therefore different commonalities under the four violations that Judge Lamberth found. Each one of them has a different policy or policies that are at issue. In other words, if the issue of whether you've done the evaluation in 120 days has different evidence underneath it, and it's a different issue than whether you've identified it as children.
Different members of the class than the other ones.
Well, that depends on whether you think the class is everybody subject to the inadequate program and therefore at risk, or those who have been harmed by the inadequate program and therefore will be entitled to individual relief. Well, there's plenty of case law around that says that the first proposition is correct, that if a program subjects me it is illegal and I am subject to it, that I have standing and I have the basis to get an injunction to straighten it out. But that's, either way, I don't think it affects our
So let me just be clear. In your amended complaint and throughout this case, the relief you're seeking, among other things, is enjoining defendants to provide, quote, compensatory education to plaintiffs, all right, whom the defendants failed to identify, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Tell me what that means.
The children who have been passed over.
Yes.
In our view, and I think that's the basis on which individual relief will be granted, we assume, is if they were passed over and they should have gotten education when they were between 3 and 5, and now they're 8 years old, that they can come in and get a program of compensatory education that will hopefully bring
get them up to speed.
Correct.
All right, so that's a programmatic
correct
request for relief. It's not a compensatory damages in the sense of money.
That's the hyper.
Well, some of the
no, that's money that's what. Well, no, no, no. I want to be clear about this because I've been somewhat confused. I see the claim for reimbursement. All right, and
may I explain that?
But could I just ask you this?
I'm sorry.
I mean, I read that to be if I, as a parent, have had to spend all this money when the District of Columbia should have been providing me my child this program, then the district has to pay me back. But the compensatory education, if my child did not get the services that the district, if the district court so rules, was required to provide, that may include money for me to hire a specialist for my child. But it's not compensatory damages. I'm trying to understand whether it's compensatory damages in the sense that I have been harmed in the amount of $50,000.
No, it's not like if you I've been hit in an
automobile
crash and now I have been damaged in some fashion.
All right. So, so in terms of the B3 class, that request for relief is this is a question, is clearly individually focused.
Absolutely.
All right. So how do you envision that proceeding in the district court? I just need to conceptually understand this, because if the district court holds that the District of Columbia has failed to provide a child find program as required under IDEA, then, and it issues this injunction, then what happens as to the plaintiffs themselves in terms of getting this compensatory education?
I can be quite definite with Your Honor, because the parties had a negotiation. They came to substantial agreement. They had disagreement on certain items, and the two proposals are pending now in front of the district court. I assume are not going to be decided until Your Honors decide this
All right,
appeal.
So the point is that conceptually, it is possible within the class framework to provide this compensatory education, even though it is individualized relief. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Yes, because all I'm saying to you, I think, is standard, the distinction between B2 and B3. B2 decides the common issues, and then if there's individual relief, you get to B3, and you develop a procedure that's either agreed upon or litigated in front of the district court to how you determine the individual relief, and that definitely is individual. There, the procedure that was agreed upon was a three by the two parties. It was a three-judge panel.
All right.
That one person would be chosen by each side. They would choose a third person. If that didn't work, they would come to the district court.
All right. So this reminds me of the Pigford case, all right, in terms of how you resolve the individual claims under a class action framework.
Go
ahead, please.
I want to just make this point that the actual litigation in this case, the actual litigation, despite counsel telling you that this case involves individual people with individual children with individual facts surrounding them, there is not one word in the record, not a word about individual children presented by the district. We presented a case involving policies, exhibits, statistics, the expert analyzing policies. The defendant replied with a mirror image. Policies. Our policies aren't very good, but they're improving. We have an expert that tells you, yes, our policies weren't good when we started this case, but we're improving. They had the chief of staff from the Office of State Superintendent of Education. She testified entirely about policies. That's what the case was about. There was no question in front of the district court that the issue was whether the policies as a whole, because we had to show the program as a whole, did not identify children adequately. The policies as a whole were totally inadequate. This was a classic B2 situation.
It was, but that was all before Walmart. And then Walmart came, and it is true that the government is continuing to try to press on this argument about individual children, but the real argument with respect to Walmart is whether each of these policies can be resolved by single injunctions, by a single injunction.
I would say, Your Honor, very simply, the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the injunction issued by the court, it does exactly that. In fact, Dr. Beer's testimony, he ran at the time of trial this program, talked about what kind of policies he was introducing so to turn this program around. They were essentially identical to our experts' statement of what policies should be done. There was agreement. Walmart doesn't change the fact as to both sides saw the issue in the case as common policies running across the class. That didn't change that. Now, maybe the district would have tried the case differently if they'd known about Walmart. I don't know that. But Walmart was not a decision about what the merits ought to look like in this case. It was a decision of when you should have a class action. And the district and the plaintiffs agreed implicitly that was involved in this case was a common set of policies, a common set of issues that could be in one stroke for each of the four violations, not one stroke for all four together, but for each of the four violations in one stroke, there could be a decision and a remedy, or in the Supreme Court's language in Walmart, an answer to each of the four violations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel just said from the podium that this class could not be resolved in one stroke. He said one stroke for each of the four violations. That itself, I think, shows that Walmart was not satisfied here. If I may return to what I said to Judge Garland before,
Counsel, Walmart, when it talks about one stroke, I don't see where it has to be one stroke addressing one policy. I mean, there can be several policies so long, says Walmart, as there is a common contention.
Right. And it's essential how they define that contention.
Yes.
I know you adverted to the for example clause in the sentence preceding. For example, the assertion of discriminatory bias on the part of the same supervisor. But that, I think, speaks to the particular context there. That's why the court said, for example, and the nature of Title VII claims. The essential part of that paragraph is the sentence that follows, which everyone has agreed sets the prevailing standard.
That common contention must be capable of class-wide resolution, one stroke.
Which means that determination of its truth or falsity will resolve an issue that is central to the validity of each one of the claims.
Right. I don't see where this court is saying there has to be only one policy when there is an overarching programmatic claim that's at issue. That's all I'm misunderstanding.
Perhaps it will help if I put it in greater context, because about four sentences before that in the same paragraph, the court says this does not mean merely that they have all suffered a violation of the same provision of law.
Right.
So merely saying that all these children have suffered a violation of the child fine portions of IDEA does not do it. They have to show something more. When I say that perhaps they could have designed a class around a particular policy or practice, with the significant caveat I gave before, I'm actually trying to explore ways in which they could have tried to show the common contention.
Right.
Absent the policy or a practice that links together an entire class, I don't know what their common contention could possibly be.
So your caveat, remind me, is?
The caveat is that the policies and procedures parts of it, really, it's difficult to see how it's even applicable here, because this is not like a Title VII claim. Title VII, as in Walmart, as the Walmart court explained, does really look to the reason for the particular challenged employment decision. So, for instance, in the Seventh Circuit cases we discussed, when the Seventh Circuit looked at the presence or absence of common policies really applicable to every class member, it was because that was relevant to each individual claim. Each individual claim what was relevant to each individual claim was the presence or absence of such a policy. Similarly, with regard to the language that you adverted to earlier, it would be relevant whether there was discriminatory bias from the same supervisor that affected the entire class. So when I say perhaps they could have shown a class designed around a particular policy or practice, I'm actually going a little further than I think we would even be needed to go. This court can assume the caveat that I gave before. It can assume that it would be sufficient for IDEA to say that there was a policy or practice that linked every class member. Assume that for a second. We don't think that would actually legally be sufficient, but assume that. Even then, they have not shown their policy or practice. And I think that's evident in their continued push to say that there should be some classes, that an error is harmless.
All right.
That cannot be right.
So assume for the moment that your position is Walmart mandates subclasses, and that the one stroke can only address one policy at a time. So we get, hypothetically, four class actions that are filed addressing each policy. It's consolidated in the discretion of the district court. How does the case differ?
I think the case differs crucially.
All right, why?
I think we have not yet gone through the analysis whether these subclasses actually pass muster under Rule 23. Any of these subclasses pass the numerosity test, for instance? We just don't know.
No, I understand that. My hypothetical was just assume that you have a subclass for each policy. All right, that seems to be your argument about Walmart, that the one stroke can only address one policy.
With the caveat I gave before, but yes, with that caveat. The caveat distinguishing the nature of an IDEA claim from a Title VII claim.
So the only... Your caveat, just so I'm very clear about this, means that every child in subclass one, no, strike that, every plaintiff in subclass one failed to be identified by his or her third birthday. Mm-hmm. In class two, every plaintiff did not get the evaluation with 120 days. Class three, they didn't get the transition to which they were entitled.
Let me consolidate those
three, and the injunction in one swoop has to address all three. So you're saying that if the district court doesn't consolidate those, then three district court judges are going to be hearing evidence, the same evidence that this district court judge has already heard. I mean, I'm trying to understand why would the Supreme Court, in a very different context, come out with a rule that says we want to splinter these cases in this way, placing greater burdens not only on the plaintiffs but on the courts, when one stroke doesn't say one stroke can only address one policy. That's what I want to be clear about.
Right, and there were a lot of threads there. Let me try to unpack them. First, of course, we should take the Walmart court at its word. It was interpreting Rule 23 and its legal requirements. It was not looking to the practical effects of what it thought the proper interpretation was. That's number one. Number two is I'm not sure that it would be the same evidence that was presented to the various district courts in hypothetical. I think this case proceeded from the outset on the wrong track. From the outset, this class was improperly certified, and we've opposed certification from the outset. So when opposing counsel speaks of how we agreed, implicitly at least, that this could be, the field of battle would be defined by the policies, it's because the district court had already improperly certified the case. We were, of course, acting with the fact that there had been a validly certified class. We had to do something. Number three, returning to your hypothetical with the various classes, the subclasses perhaps, where the class one is all the children who are not identified by their third birthday. Let me unpack that a little more to illustrate further the nature of my caveat. Let's say within that class are plaintiffs A and B. Plaintiffs A and B have very similar sounding claims. Each of them claims that they were not identified by the cutoff date. But neither of their claims depends at all upon the existence or absence of a policy, nor does it depend on what happened with regard to the other plaintiff. Each of those plaintiff's claims is crucially individualized. Plaintiff A, for instance, would say, I have a disability, I was not identified, period. Plaintiff B's claims do not depend at all on the truth of validity of Plaintiff A's contentions. Plaintiff B has a similar claim, but not the same contention. Plaintiff B's claim relies upon whether Plaintiff B was identified, not whether Plaintiff A was. That's the nature of our caveat, because IDEA is thereby significantly different from a Title VII case. In a Title VII case, for instance, where the reason for the challenged promotion or non-promotion decision is key to the claim, plaintiffs A and B in that hypothetical class might say the same thing. Our supervisor was biased. A court can efficiently deal with that common contention in a class action. Not so with an IDEA claim. That's the nature of our caveat.
But I'm thinking of cases like the cases that women brought against the State Department who were denied assignments in the Foreign Service. Plaintiff A didn't get it for reason B. Plaintiff B didn't get it for reason C. Plaintiff C wasn't even eligible. I mean, but they were all within the class because of the claim that there was a policy within a unit of the State Department that was discriminating against this group of plaintiffs who, in that case, constitutional rights were being violated. Under your Walmart caveat, you couldn't have a class action.
I don't think that's quite right, Your Honor, but it depends on the facts of the particular
case. I know,
case.
But I'm trying to understand exactly where you're going, because the caveat undermines even the subclass.
Well, our caveat doesn't speak at all to Title VII or other discrimination.
No, I know, because you're saying that basically an IDEA after Walmart, you can't have a class action.
No, we're not saying we're that.
Almost
this particular
that.
Kind of IDEA claim, I think it's very questionable if there could be one. There are other IDEA contexts in which there could be one. Mm-hmm. But again, it doesn't speak to the question for this court whether in the future there could be IDEA class actions of this nature. What matters is what Rule 23 requires. But if I may just finish, and I know I'm wildly over time, but responding to your inquiry, and then one final coda to that.
We'll have a few more because I've got questions for you.
Oh, sure. But responding to what you said before and your hypothetical, the Supreme Court in Walmart actually spoke to a similar hypothetical. It said that possibly a class could be justified if there were significant proof of a general policy of discrimination where that general policy manifested itself across the entire class. Even assuming we got past my caveat about the nature of IDEA claims as opposed to discrimination claims, plaintiffs have not shown any such general policy of not finding children. It's simply absent here. So, and much
even
less have they shown
8%?
That it manifests. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Even if you're at 8%?
I don't. 8%, I don't
know. I'm just saying, if the proof is that, you know, the policy is so inadequate that you.
That's a very different question, Your Honor. The question whether the district claim is doing a good enough job is a different question from whether it has a general policy of the type the Supreme Court talked about in Walmart. And it's important that we hold to Walmart, not just because we have to, but also because it speaks to the functionality of the class action system. We're talking about whether a class can be designed such that, in the Supreme Court's words, is apt to drive the resolution of the litigation. If, for instance, a plaintiff came in and said, I have statistical proof that the LA Police Department commits more Fourth Amendment violations than any other police department in the country. Is that alone sufficient to justify class action? We don't think so. I don't think the Supreme Court and Walmart would think so either.
Well, I mean, strike across the country in Los Angeles County. I mean, all right. Yeah. But go ahead, finish your answer, because Judge Garland has some questions.
I'm happy to entertain the order.
All right.
Are you finished answering?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we've been focusing on 23A and the language in Walmart about 23A. There's also the language about 23B2.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And that says, in other words, 23B2 applies only when a single injunction would provide relief to each member of the class. Isn't that the answer to the question about whether you can have an injunction with many, many subparts, which is what we have here, where each subpart applies to different members of the class, that can't be allowed under Walmart, that you can't have a multi-part injunction unless there's at least one part that applies to everyone in the class?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
And that's why I use the word single.
That's right, and indivisible as well.
I'm sorry?
And indivisible as well.
That's the preceding sentence.
That's right. What we're asking the court to do here is in our view, a fairly modest step. We do think that the class certification decision needs to be vacated, and that necessarily, in the absence of any valid class, the remedial and liability orders need to be vacated as well. We ask this court to take the step. It can assume the caveat I spoke to before. It can assume that a class can be designed around a single policy or practice and leave it to the district court to see whether or not, in the exercise of its discretion, such a class can be designed.
But let me ask you, I mean, I'm looking at B2. It's talking about the, quote, the party opposing the class has acted or refused to act on grounds that apply generally to the class so that the final injunctive relief or corresponding declaratory relief is appropriate respecting the class as a whole.
Right, Your Honor. We think that supports the district's position here, even without the gloss that the Supreme Court gave it in Walmart.
So I don't see the caveat. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, the caveat doesn't come from Rule. Sorry, the caveat I was giving you before was relevant to Rule 23A2.
That's right.
Not relevant to Rule 23B2.
That's right.
23B2 is a separate part of the
right. Rule. So it doesn't have all this that you're talking about.
Right, but the plaintiffs have to satisfy, of course,
a
both
first.
Parts in order right. to justify their class. Mm-hmm. And going back to the text of B2, as Your Honor indicated, the party opposing the class has to have acted or refused to act on grounds generally applicable to the class as a whole. We
all
simply
right, so
fail
a,
to see how that was shown here.
But A talks about classes so numerous, there are questions of law or fact common. Claims or defenses are typical, you know, and fairly adequately represent.
Yes, Your Honor, and we haven't spoken about the other prongs of Rule 23.
No, no, no.
As the court knows, we have some concerns with other portions of them. We think it's sufficient for this court either to conclude that Rule 23A2 was not met here because the Walmart standard for commonality was not satisfied, or that B2 wasn't met because there was no showing of the type of claim to an indivisible single injunction that Walmart required. If there are no further questions.
And then I guess the district's main point is that so I'm clear as to your caveat, is that an individual plaintiff can sue, and otherwise it's the Secretary of Education who has to superintend, or the district government executive branch has to make changes to, or the schools have to make changes to the policies.
I think that's largely right. As I said, we're not foreclosing the possibility of idea class actions. I don't think this court needs to go that far, but certainly there's always at least the possibility that individuals can seek their own relief. Class actions, of course, as the Supreme Court has recognized, are the exception. Individually focused suits are the norm. And we think, absent a valid class, the named plaintiffs here should be left to the norm. They should seek the relief that they are entitled to for themselves.
The secretary took action against the city, and the system was still broken. The city changed chancellors, changed mayors. The program was still broken. Individual plaintiffs were suing, and some were able to bring their cases to court, and the system was still broken. So Rule 23 is simply not available after Walmart.
No, Your Honor.
I know you keep saying no, but I'm really pressing you on this because you're not agreeing that if there is a single policy, you could have a subclass after Walmart because the first plaintiff may have one reason, the second plaintiff may have another reason for alleging that its rights are violated by the policy. So to me, the caveat is if the plaintiffs aren't identically affected by the policy, there can be no subclass after Walmart under Rule 23.
Now, let me be clear about the nature of our caveat. And again, this court can get past this point if it simply wants to assume that IDEA would function like a discrimination statute for purposes of this case. The nature of our caveat is if Plaintiff A, returning to my hypothetical, comes in, his claims are entirely individualized. He says the district did not identify me. I am disabled. plaintiff B may have very similar claims, and they may be, let's say, been affected by the same policy in the same way. But the point is, what the genesis of the district's failure was as to either of these plaintiffs, it's just not part of the claim they would bring to court. But assume that away. The point here, the overarching point, is that the plaintiffs did not design their case in that way in the first place. They sought to attack the child fine system as a generalized whole. And whatever reasoning this court adopts in order to reach the conclusion, we think the only possible conclusion is that Walmart does not countenance that result.
I have to say I'm confused about the way you've argued this part. At some point, I thought you were arguing this as an issue about class actions with respect to Rule 23. At some points, I thought you were arguing this as to whether there's a class action permitted under the IDEA. So imagine that we solve the Rule 23 problem. The statute says the state has to have in effect policies and procedures to ensure state meets the following conditions, and the state announces, we don't care, we're not going to do it. We have no policy, nothing in effect at all. And therefore, no child in our district will ever get a FAPE. And there's a class action brought by all children who are disabled and have tried to get a FAPE and can't get one because they have a policy. You have any doubt that this could be brought? First of all, that this satisfies Walmart. You have no doubt that a request for an injunction ordering the state to follow the IDEA and to adopt policies and procedures without specifying what they are. Would that be a Walmart problem?
It would be a problem under Walmart in the context of IDEA because of this reason. And I was trying to explain, this is the caveat I was speaking of. The reason why the district failed any particular child is not a part of any individual.
But it affects every child in the example I just gave, right? Every single child because they're not having any FAPE. So it's not the only reason they failed every child. There are additional individualized decision making that has to be made. But here is one policy that affects every child. You have a doubt that Walmart permits that kind of injunction?
I do, Your Honor, but I understand the concern, and I would
hate that's not what the Seventh Circuit said. That's, in fact, not what any circuit has said. No circuit has said that every policy that's been violated has to affect every child.
Perhaps I misunderstood the question. I didn't mean to suggest that much. My caveat is going to the nature of an IDEA.
Yes, I understand. So this is no longer a Rule 23 issue. This is your claim that IDEA, for one reason or another, doesn't allow class actions.
No. Let me try to dispel any misconception. This is an argument about Rule 23 as applied in the IDEA.
If we disagree with your interpretation of IDEA, then it is not a problem under Rule 23, correct?
Right, but let's be clear about the particular interpretation of IDEA I'm speaking of. The Supreme Court has said in Walmart that there has to be a common contention. I won't go through the whole litany of it.
Yes, and here the common contention is the state stands up and says, I don't like those guys in Washington. I'm just not going to permit FAPEs at all, even for the most disabled of our children.
Right, and the problem for Walmart, and I would hasten to say again, this court need not even reach the issue because it can decide this case based on the absence of a common policy or practice linking this whole class. But the problem with that for Walmart purposes is that no individual's claim depends on the reason why they were failed. So it could be that the district has this hypothetical blanket policy.
Let's say there's a class of 1,000 children, all of whom are disabled, and none of whom can get any benefits from the district at all because they are stopped, as Judge Edwards says, at the door by a rule that says we're not going to give you any benefits at all. Why isn't that a common fact issue solvable by a single injunction?
You conceded this. Why are we going back over this over and over and over? You've already conceded that if it's a closed door, that's got to be a policy that can be attacked. The Seventh Circuit said it. The Fifth Circuit has said it. Supreme Court did not say anything to the contrary.
With respect, I conceded it with the caveat that I tried to articulate.
I don't know what your caveat is. Your caveat seems to be what Judge Rogers says. You conceded and you say, oh, incidentally, we don't agree to anything. I don't know what you're talking about. If there's a closed door policy, you can't come in. That clearly is the first question of courts that's common to every single person who has the prospect of being covered by IDEA. They're within an appropriate class. Walmart does not block a class action in that circumstance.
Well, I certainly have no desire to fight with the court about this. I think we went on other grounds.
You do. We've been doing it for an hour and a half now.
I've been trying to respond to questions from the court. And we do have a view as to Walmart's application.
I don't care.
Obviously think
I'm sitting here in disbelief now. I understood before. I don't know what you're talking about anymore. If you have a close-the-door policy, you really, the district is now asserting to this court, you're asserting on behalf of the district, a closed-door, shut-the-door policy that affects everyone who would be covered by IDEA. There can be no class action?
Closed-door policy.
I'm using that.
I know.
Descriptive, all right?
I know, and I know this is the hypothetical, and the District of Columbia, of course,
I understand.
This. We understand that, and we're just talking hypothetically here. But I'm trying to drill down and really speak to what Walmart said. And Walmart said that the common contention has to have an up or down resolution that violates, there has to be an up or down resolution of the common contention, and the resolution of that common contention has to be central to the validity of each one of the claims. If you break down the class that you're proposing, each individual there would say something like, I was not found.
No. Each individual will say, I can't get in the door. We're not even up to findings yet.
You heard my example of the policy. The policy is we are not going to follow IDEA at all. That's what it said. Now, isn't it the case that every individual who is disabled has a claim that the district follow IDEA? And if the district's going in policy is we are not going to follow it, everyone has a common claim that their rights are being violated.
Please just say yes.
I don't understand why that's not.
This really is hard. You're a smart guy. This is not a trick question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree with the first part of that, perhaps. I'm trying my best here. I really do think that there is a disconnect between perhaps the court's understanding of Walmart and mine. But again, the court just didn't reach the issue. Here,
in a way, you've now forced us to reach the issue, which is unfortunate for the District of Columbia. No. But you have forced us to reach the issue.
How so? I don't understand.
Stunning argument.
Because we know you're going to make the argument below that it's not possible, even if there is a single policy that will affect every single member of the class, which can be solved by a single injunction, that Walmart doesn't permit that. And Walmart expressly does permit that.
I may be overreading Walmart. Walmart says that we look at the portions of the claim. And the common contention must be central to every part of, sorry.
Not to every part.
I misspoke. The common contention must be central to each claimant.
Yes.
So when you break it down, I mean, this is much of what Judge Brown spoke of in her concurrence in Blackmun. It's very individualized. And crucially different from the Title VII context and the discrimination context, the reasons why any child was not found are not part of the claim. I'm trying to be reasonable. I really am, but my understanding of it is perhaps different.
I realize you. I don't know what you're not understanding. The child only wants to assert, I can't get in the door, and I have a right to at least get in the door. That's all I want to assert. I don't even want to tell you what I think is wrong with me. I just want to get in the door.
And let me be quite clear that we're not saying that child cannot sue to get in the door. Of course that child can.
Along with the other 1,000 who have exactly the same claim. I just want to get in the door.
Right, and that's the question. I understand that's the question. But let me emphasize, the Supreme Court's decision in Walmart, we think, sets the standard, and we're just trying to fairly apply that standard here. And I should emphasize also that, of course, this court, for purposes of this case, need not reach argument two.
Judge Garland suggested, now you forced us to. We have no choice.
Well, I'm not
trying
to force you.
Otherwise, it just comes back to us.
You've made it absolutely clear.
All right.
I'm not suggesting anyway that we'll say this. And the problem also is that the subclass proposal that the court, that my opponents have given, is something that first the district court has to consider in its discretion. It has to consider numerosity, typicality, and
that's a different question
right,
than the basic underlying law.
All right. I think we have your argument. Is that correct?
Unless the court has further questions.
Oh. All right. Thank you. Yes. Briefly.
Very good.
All right.
V2, if led literally, would mean you can never have subclasses. Because by definition, the subclasses, will never have the injunctive relief will be based on the subclasses. In the Johnson case, Judge Posner's case, it's inevitable that the he said some of the plaintiffs are in.
Well, it's not really what I don't think it's in, at all inevitable that you can't have subclasses. If each subclass has at least one injunction that resolves the subclass,
exactly,
maybe
right.
That's good enough. Or, and maybe the best way for you guys to protect yourself the next time is to call them separate classes rather than subclasses. So when it gets up here, we don't have a debate about whether subclasses are important or not. They can just call them separate classes.
I agree with that, Your
Honor. I mean, the problem there is magic words or you lose. All right. The problem there is magic words or you lose. And we're trying to talk about substance here. All right. Mr. Counsel for the district, did you have to?
No.
I'm just, no, in fairness. In
no,
fairness.
We know your position.
I just want to be clear. Fine. All right. The case is submitted. Thank you.